Okay. Welcome to Talking Sense, the mobile driving in your car edition.
Hello.
Most of you listen to the podcast in the car, so we figured why not film the podcast in a car? So today I'm in Switzerland, and I figured why not do a podcast with Laure from Shenzhen, which is a French/Swiss detection dog company, right?
Exactly.
Welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit about you.
What do you want to know about me?
How did you get into detection dogs, doing the nose work?
Actually, I came to detection almost by accident because I was dog trainer. And someday, a friend of mine called me and said, oh, have you seen in the newspaper? There's a guy in Geneva doing bed bug detection. And I was like, no, what's that? Actually, I knew about detection, like bomb detection, dog detection, but I hadn't any clue about what's a bed bug.
Yeah.
And straight away she said, would you like us to train our dogs to do this? And I was like, no. Actually, I didn't know what a bed bug was.
Sure.
And for me, I didn't have the right dogs to do it because I have bulldogs. And I was like, "What? Why did she call me to ask me this? That is stupid. Bulldogs, they can't do that." So I said, no, thank you. I'm fine. Mm-hmm. And then she said, oh, think about it. And I was like, yeah, okay. Just, you know, to get like sort of rid of her. And 2 weeks later, she called me back. Did you think about it? And I said, thought about what? And she said, the bed bugs. And I told her, I said, no. And she was so persistent that, you know, in the end, I said, okay, let's do it. But, you know, in my head, I was, that would be a failure. But I was thinking, okay, just let's try. And anyway, I learned new things and it's going to be fun. That was a new challenge.
Yep.
And so I started training a first dog and then later a second dog. And at that time, it was 2012.
Okay.
So 11 years ago. And there was not much information. Like now, there's your website,
sure. Yeah.
Which provides lots of webinars and lots of information and scientist papers. But at that time, there was nothing. I just found out like maybe 5 or 6 videos on YouTube about guys in USA training for bed bugs. So, but then I knew like classical conditioning, operant conditioning. So I've been able to do the link in my head. Plus, then we trained with a retired police officer.
Okay.
That knew perfectly detection job.
Yeah.
So we went through this journey, and I had 2 dogs certified in 2014. So I worked a little bit into the bed bug detection dog for about 2 years. Yeah. And then I got pregnant.
Okay.
So that was not really convenient to do it when you have a baby. So I just quit because that was too much work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So after you started off in bed bugs, then got pregnant, you had a business that you did, pet supplies? And
no,
things?
It was, that was before.
Okay.
No, at that time I was just dog trainer.
Okay.
So like, you know, pet dog trainer, basic obedience, anything people would like to do, also like fun things, a little bit of dog tricks, you know, the basics.
Yeah. Okay. And so after bed bugs, then you got into sport detection, correct?
Yeah. And this is about pretty much the same story. It was, yeah, when I stopped bed bugs, because, you know, I was saying, yeah, I can't do this anymore. This is too much. I have to train my dogs every day, which I can't with a baby that was taking all my attention.
Yep.
And it's amazing because it's 2 friends from like two different locations, one on the other side of Switzerland and the other one from the other side of France. And they started saying, you've seen there's this new sport in USA. It's sport detection. I was like, yeah, okay. I didn't hear about that. I'll send you the link. I'll send you the articles. And why don't you launch this? Why don't you train people on sport detection? Mm-hmm. I was like, no, I have a baby.
Yeah.
I'm busy right now. I don't have time. And they came back a couple of times. So in the end, I was like, okay, let's do it. And so how I started in 2017.
Okay.
I gave my first workshop. But at that time, it was primary searching.
Okay.
Like, you know,
search anything. Search for toy or
it
food.
It would be or food or toy. Mm-hmm. Like, it was dog's preference. And actually, it was when it comes really, like, to sport, I started in 2019 with Natalie Dubrow.
Yep.
That she came to Switzerland, and she gave us a workshop on, you know, how mm-hmm. it works, how to start, everything. And at that time, we also had our first trial.
Okay.
So it was all in one.
Wow. So that's really learning very quickly, like going, I'm going to show you guys how to do it. And then here's a trial to have this experience.
Yeah. And it was funny because there were some dogs that they entered the trial just a week after starting, which was really challenging.
Sure.
It was far from being perfect, but it was okay. And there was already a couple of dogs that were on it was Novice, so it was on Birch. Mm-hmm. I had two dogs. There were people coming from France. They also had a couple of dogs. So it was still a bit of competition. But, you know, we were all beginning.
Yeah.
So it was more like discovering the thing and having fun. It was not like a hard competition.
Sure. How much has it grown as a sport over here in Europe, specifically, I guess, Switzerland and France?
Yeah. So we started in September 19. Mm-hmm. And I think the second trial was supposed to be April 20, but okay. We all know what happened.
Yes. COVID.
Yeah, yeah. So everything stopped. I was still able to, you know, apart from the lockdowns, to give seminars and actually webinars because we were all home. Mm-hmm. So there was regularly people starting.
Yep.
And in the end, that trial was like in August between two lockdowns.
Okay.
And I was really surprised because I didn't know, you know, how many people would be there. And I think I had something like 18 dogs, which was really good because again, you have to think about how the situation was in USA, maybe 10 years ago.
Sure.
So it was, yeah, and it's still pretty confidential, but I can see more and more people coming.
Well, how many competitions do you guys have now, let's say, in a year?
I'm doing three.
Okay.
And there's a colleague, Sylvie, she mm-hmm. did one. I'm doing three pretty big.
Okay.
And another two or three that are classic ones, so smaller.
Okay.
Just like four trials, like one in each element. So that makes, I would say, less than 10.
Okay.
For sure, in Switzerland. And France, they're starting to offering, but I think they had two so far. So it's gradually coming.
Sure. And at a competition, how many teams are typically competing?
It depends. Now we have, as we have gone through all levels, we have dogs in any level right okay. now. We have novice to master. There was at first, everyone was a novice. So we had very big groups of novice, then big groups of intermediate. And now it's pretty much into not each level, because I can see that now the biggest groups are intermediate and advanced.
Okay.
Because, yeah, you know, it's novice is very easy. There's one order to find. It's the setup is made for success.
You said it's one order to find, and it's only the dog is only trained on that one odor. They don't have to be on multiple odors yet.
Exactly. Okay. So people usually go pretty fast through that. And then intermediate, you have two orders and you have to call finish.
Okay. Yep.
Which is a challenge for some people.
Mm-hmm.
And then advance, of course, three orders. So it becomes a bit more complicated. So at some point, some people and maybe some dogs start to struggle a bit to communicate together. It makes them stay a bit longer in these categories than, you know, novice. And people that are through senior and masters are those that are really invested, and they invest time to train mm-hmm. hard. Yeah.
In the intermediate category, are they only searching one type of element, or are they searching like rooms, outside, vehicles, container? Is it, how does that work?
Yeah, it's because we go by USCSS.
Okay.
So we go through the four elements.
Okay.
Which, you know, are vehicles, exterior, interior,
mm-hmm.
and containers.
Yep. Okay.
Which you have seen these days can be a bit challenging for some dogs, like smashing the boxes.
Uh-huh. I was going to say the similarities between what the U.S. competitions or the various, because obviously now in the United States, we have not only USCSS, but of course, Nosework, NACSW, and then the AKC. And I know from time to time, UKC has theirs. So there's potentially four different sporting programs. However, there's two main ones that are probably the most popular. And the things that you talk about, that the struggles and or the challenges, it's the same in the United States as I see the same here. So the good thing is everybody's in good company because they all have similar struggles they work through.
Mm-hmm.
What's your guys' advanced like? Is it like longer, like a bigger search area, more obviously multiple odors?
Yeah, so it's like three odors and known, mm-hmm. numbers known.
Mm-hmm.
And that I would say it's, we had to adjust the sport, like especially the surface, I mean, the size of the search area, because in USA you've got huge venues.
Sure,
You have access to very big places, mm-hmm. which... You have seen that here we have
a little bit smaller. Yep.
Everything is smaller.
Yes.
Food is smaller.
Yep.
Cars are smaller. So, of course, the areas like dog clubs are smaller. Everything we have access to is smaller. So we have to adjust. So we do our best to find enough space.
Yep.
But sometimes as we don't always have access to huge places,
mm-hmm.
we make it like more crowded, mm-hmm. or, you know, we arrange for it to be still challenging for an advanced, but sometimes size cannot fit the criteria.
Yep, for sure. All right, time for a cafe.
Yeah, so we are back on the road.
Back on the road again. We got our food. We're going to fuel up with our energy so we can go do some teaching today.
Yeah.
With, what would you say is some of the biggest challenges with the growth of the sport here in Europe?
I don't really know, because, you know, I'm doing the thing and I try to have, you know, to gather people around it,
mm-hmm.
but I don't really have a long-term vision. I'm pretty sure, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that it's, I think it's going to be just like USA. It will soon become something everyone wants to do. And I can understand that because when you see how fast dogs get it, because it's so natural for them, and how fun it is for people to see their dog's progress.
Yeah.
It's really rewarding for the dog and for the people. So I can understand that it became like probably, what is it, number one sport in USA? Or number two?
What would you say, Natalie? In the top five, at least?
Top five.
Yeah.
So I can understand because it's agility probably like in USA is very popular here. Mm-hmm. But you need like a full field of things.
Yeah.
You need like tunnels, jumps, the A-frame, and with detection, all you need is your dog, order, treats, or toy,
mm-hmm.
and there you go.
Yeah.
Just an area to put the order at, mm-hmm. and that's it. So I think you mentioned like man training is
yes.
more popular here than USA.
For civilians, yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's the male man trailing and tracking is definitely, there's a lot of people that are interested in it, but I would say over here for sure, the number of pet people that do it for fun is a lot more than in the United States.
Yeah, and I think it's because of some instructors or some dog trainers started it,
mm-hmm.
and other dog trainers jumped in because scent work in general, not only nose work as a sport, but you know everything about scent work with dogs is becoming really popular because many people can see the benefit.
Yeah.
Of a dog doing it, like even like dogs with behavioral problems, they can benefit from it. So it's really for everyone. And training was introduced first in, I would say, France and Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
but also, I guess, Germany. That's where it's, at the moment, more popular.
Sure.
Whereas, like, the northern countries, European northern countries, like Sweden, and also UK, they're more advanced in these sport aspect of
sure.
detection than we are. I think they were probably the first ones. But as again, man trailing, you need a team, you need a coach,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You need someone at least to go and hide. So you can't do this by yourself, which is, I would say, the weak point of
sure.
man trailing. And again, as I said, detection way easier.
Yeah. And it's funny, as you're talking there, it made me think, why is man trailing tracking not as big as a sport in the United States? And actually what I think it is, so many people in the States do search and rescue. So instead of it being a sport, they get into it as volunteer rescue. But what makes that even more unique is over here, you guys have Red Dog. And that is search and rescue, but there's much more strict standards. And in the States, it can depend on where you're at and what's required. And is your group, did you make up your own group? Are you a part of a bigger group? Or here it is one state run organization. And those that want to get into it, and I would call it more of a professional level, do Red Dog. And then all the ones who just want to enjoy doing tracking and man trailing do the sport. Since we don't have that sport per se in the United States, like you guys do here, I think if we did, we would probably see more of a split start to happen. You would see people go, okay, that satisfies my need to go search for people. I can have fun with my dog. But right now, their only way to do that, in a sense, is to join a search and rescue organization.
Yeah, that's true. And that's a good point. If you want to be, Red Dog is Swiss, and if you want to be part of it, it's very hard to get that. You have to probably like follow them for a year without your dog.
Uh-huh.
Then you have to pass the obedience test. So they're going to evaluate, and then you can start. And when you're following them for a year, you're acting as, I would say, helper.
Uh-huh.
You might be the person who's going to be buried somewhere for another dog to find you. And it's you really have to be committed. And it's asking a lot of hours. Like, yeah, you wake up at, maybe the meeting point is 5 a.m. So you have to wake up at 3:30 or 4 on weekends.
Yeah.
So really need high motivation,
sure,
to do it. Whereas, you know, when training, there's a meeting point after work. You go, you enjoy for 2-3 hours with other people and then go home. So it's not, you know,
yeah,
as much asking. I mean, time consuming,
yeah,
or investment. Then, because as you mentioned, like, Red Dog is really strict, and it's not professional, but almost, because it's,
sure,
people are still volunteer.
Yeah.
But we don't have like the search and rescue, mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm, you have.
And what's, I think, even because many of the things that you mentioned, a lot of the search and rescue people do, but it depends on where they're at. Some programs are strict and they have, like, you have to be a helper for so long. I know in California, they have rules similar to this. And it's to see who's committed, who will put in the time needed and be a good representative of the research and rescue organization. But with that said, I could travel across a state line and then the rules are very different. So, it's an interesting topic, like how that, you know, the organizations over here in comparison to the organizations in the States, there's similarities. And then, of course, there's very distinct differences, too. But like I said, to me, the biggest or the most unique was how tracking is, or man trailing is, a sport. So those probably watching this or listening to this may get an idea and say, hey, there's all these different other sports. We should make a man trailing sport or a tracking sport.
Yeah.
So especially those that I'm over here, obviously, in Switzerland. And maybe, I think, 2 weeks ago, Jeff Shetler was here doing classes and seminars and so forth. So there will probably be more people that might, hey, reach out to him, even though I know he's busy enough. But hey, it's an idea. Maybe something will happen from something like this.
Yeah, but so he and his, like, instructor teams, mm-hmm, in Europe are the ones that probably promoted the most man training.
Mm-hmm.
There are some other schools, but they're doing a very good job, and now they're searching to, yeah, promote it more, have more, mm-hmm, instructors, because,
yeah,
they're at some point that there's more demand,
mm-hmm,
than offers. So,
sure,
there's more people wanting to do it than certified instructors to,
oh, wow,
to make
to help
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So people during my training, they know that when there's an event, they have to be quick to book their,
wow,
spot. Otherwise, within like 2 hours, it's full.
Just like Nose Work the United States.
Okay.
Yeah. They make a post about there's going to be a trial, and Natalie and all her friends are like watching the countdown to 1 second, and they're all like, enter. And then, you know, like, yeah, they're like, yeah. So anyway, but that's probably what they'll have to start doing over here for the mandrake. Maybe make a lottery out of it and see, you know, did your number get picked or not? I also kind of sometimes question the lottery effect. You know, is it truly a lottery? Is it like, I like these people, they get a number, and these ones don't? So, because I'm like, it's always odd how the same ones or certain ones get in all the time. I'm like, you either have amazing luck, so you should go play the real lottery. So, but now, as a trainer, and I would say also coach, instructor, how do you, what would you do? Or how do you deal with, you know, just working with people, and what are the lessons that you've learned as kind of in your own journey as a coach and instructor?
I learned so much.
Oh, yeah.
Is it a problem?
I think it has stabilization, so we'll see.
Okay.
We'll find out.
People will get sick.
Exactly. We will find out.
The first thing I learned is, as I mentioned, the benefit that people and dog as a team can benefit from doing nose work or detection, and how rewarding it is for both. The second thing I learned, and it was a bit surprising for me because, and you talked about it on the workshop, like containers are the basic. And I always liked containers. So my dogs are pretty strong in containers. And when we've been through all the levels, it's always been the first element we finish.
Yeah.
Because for us, it's easy and I would say natural to go through it. And by coaching people, I started realizing how complicated it could be for some dogs, because you've got the type of dog that get bored because it's always looking the same.
Yeah.
You've got dogs that wants to interact with the containers, especially if it's boxes. But some even try to interact with like heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Or put the paws on, and that's where I realize how easy it could be and how complicated it could be. So it was a good, I would say, school for me to learn how to manage these playing box dogs.
Yep.
So they would be maybe calmer around the boxes, or they would, find solutions so they wouldn't play with the boxes. So that was fun to learn, and also to coach people how to behave and how to handle these boxes issues. So that makes people struggling with their dogs around boxes, that makes them not liking the boxes, which is sometimes a good idea because you've got other options. But as I like to use boxes for any trouble shooting, sometimes I'm like, yeah, but you should still try the boxes or manage to have your dog around boxes, even though it's not mandatory.
Sure. What would you say is something that you've learned or you've adapted as an instructor dealing with people, like communicating to people and like how your style would be, or lessons you've learned? Like, I used to teach like this, but now I've made some changes. I've learned some lessons, and I found for me, like, this kind of technique or this way of communication works.
I don't think I have any that is defined.
Okay.
I always try to look at who's in front of me, whether it would be the person or the dog, and find the right tool for them.
Okay.
Because as I said, you know, some dogs are challenging around boxes, so I can't just throw boxes and say, there you go, have fun. Because it's not going to work. There are also people that are good at timing, you know, reward time, time reward.
Yep.
And others are not. So as every person and every team is different, and I think that's the job of a trainer to find solution for that team.
Yeah.
Whereas, and I always tell my students when I've got like workshop or group class, don't worry, because I may say to a person, do this, and to another, never do this.
Yeah.
So, and I warn them because it could be confusing. Like, but you said the other person that she should like reward now, and you're telling me to wait longer. And I'm like, yeah, because that dog is not ready and your dog is ready. So that's just, you know, an example for others. But
it's a great example because that happens quite frequently. You know, sometimes if you train with another trainer, sometimes in a situation with one trainer, there's something that they see with that dog, and then they do that session with that trainer, then they go to the other trainer in the other search area, and that trainer says, do the complete opposite. And it's a struggle for that student to go to not have confusion because they're going, well, one of you says this, then the other one says this. Now I'm even more confused. And because, like you just said, there's the, we're looking at it from the dog's point of view or the objective of that session. And in that particular session, this was a technique that worked really well. But on the next one, we wouldn't do that for a different reason. So, and when you're new as a handler, it's super confusing. And then let's just say we throw social media on top of it. When there's social media and there's so much information, like which person do we listen to?
Films and images, but most of the time without explanation. So
Yeah, they see something and they're like, well, I want my dog to do that. It looks like they did it this way on here. Yeah.
And I also start seeing, because it's, again, becoming popular, like people are now starting to know about detection. And since also, like, there's my book in French, so now information is a bit more accessible to any people.
Yep.
I can see more and more, you know, workshops growing with different people. And I see also, like, workshop where the instructor asks everything, I mean, for every dog to do the same. And I had a student that came to me. She was training with professionals, but I mean, detection professionals, they were, I think they were doing explosive.
Okay.
And, but she has a pet dog working, but still pet.
Yeah.
And that's a Pyrenees shepherd.
Okay.
And she was supposed, the dog was supposed to go through like boxes and to go to every, check every boxes like their Malinois would do it. But at some point, the dog, she would go straight to the right box. And
they want him to go to the other boxes first.
Yeah. And they were saying, no, she has to check every box. She was like, yeah, but she found the right box because, and we know sometimes they know from the start line where the odor's at because it's maybe strong or it's just pulling straight into their head, their nose.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, it's stupid to ask, like, the dog has to check every box.
Yeah.
So at some point they said, oh, no, your dog is shit. This is not for your dog. Because the dog
didn't do their system.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So she stopped for a while. And then I think she stopped for like 6 or 12 months. And then she called me. She said, yeah, I was doing this with my dog. I liked it. And I think she liked it. But then she just told me what I told you.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, so we can see if there's a motivation problem or what we can do. And so she came to my field and, you know, for an evaluation, I go from, you know, scratch, I mean, from nothing. And I, so I just started the dog from zero, but of course she went way faster because she knew the job and the dog is great and the person is having fun. So sometimes, and again, it joins what I told you, I really adjust to the dog and the person. Mm-hmm. And there's no, like, one method that you can apply to everyone or every dog. You really need to take the person and the dog and the team.
Yep. And you bring up a point, as the detection dog sports grew, the only people to reach out to in the beginning stages were those from the professional community who knew detection, but knew it re in relation to professionals' ways of doing
And
it.
a certain type of dog.
Yes. And I come from that world, and I had my own struggles initially too, because certain things didn't make sense to me. Like, why would you guys do it this way? Just as if you guys were to watch, like you said, you watch a trainer in that system, why would you make them check these things? And when you're a bomb dog, it is a tough one too, because, and like I said, no matter what the detection discipline is, it's like, how much do you require detail or go to odor? Obviously, go to odor is really important. But at the same time, under certain types of disciplines, there's risk if you don't follow a pattern of some type. So there's this trade-off, like, what do I give in order to get this? But the point that you made is one that I definitely share and talk about a lot more now as I've progressed as a person and as an instructor, is I want to work with as many different teams as possible. I want to share this amazing discipline of detection with as many people as I can and as many dogs as I can. And in order to do that and to be a skilled trainer, I have to have numerous tools in my toolbox so I can work with dogs with really high motivation or dogs with low motivation. Or handlers who learn this way, or handlers who learn that way. Or maybe, like you said, their timing and their skill levels are new versus somebody who's been doing it a long time and may come to you with their own habits. And those habits may not be ideal for this particular type of detection. So it's one thing I really have gotten behind nowadays to try to share with those that get into training is they're going to see certain systems by other trainers that are very specific that work really well for the, like you said, the type of dogs that they work with, the type of detection that they do. And at face value, if you're new or you're getting out there, it can look really cool, but and it is, it's just not the same thing that works best for your dog. And if that trainer likes to do their system, more power to them. They're great. Go for it. If you want to be more diverse and reach to more people, like the position I want to be in, I want my toolbox to have a lot of tools in it, and I want to be able to be diversify how I can engage. So.
And probably the main our main goal, the main reason we do that job, it's because of the challenge.
Yeah.
We're so long in that industry. I'm the trainer for over 20 years. You're there, I think, even longer.
Yep. Been a minute.
And we like it because it's not boring. Every
Correct.
day is different
Yeah.
because every person and every dog is different.
Every search area is different.
Exactly. And every solving order problem is different. So that's why it's fun. And if you stick to, oh, it has to be like this, in my opinion, it's becoming boring.
Yeah.
And we like, I think we have like some common points
Yeah.
in terms of, what
How we
we how we
think.
think
Yeah.
and what we like. And so a learning is part of the job. It's part of, we are teachers,
Yep.
but learning, in my opinion, has a very strong is a very strong part of that job. And because we learn every day, because we learn, okay, we've got this dog, now we have to find a solution, but we probably learn as much as we teach, because most of the time I feel that every team is teaching me something,
Yeah.
because perhaps that person has a maybe health issue or physical disability.
Yep.
That's how you say
Yeah,
it.
yeah,
Sorry for my English.
Sure. No, it's correct.
So you have to make adjustment or find solution, or maybe that dog has history of like strong focus on the handler, but now we have to teach that dog to go away from the handler and teach, and search independently. So there's always, I think with every team, there's a challenge. And this is what fills my brain and probably yours too, to find, as you said, like the right tool, but also like the right, maybe environment management or all these things.
Yep.
And I think this is like probably the most rewarding thing for me, that I learn as much as I teach.
Yeah, it is very rewarding.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very challenging. That's so fun, you know, the constant differences, from the type of dog I'm working with to the type of person. You know, for me, when I was first getting into detection, that really attracted me to it was this constant challenge of I've got to beat the person or thing that's being hidden from me and my dog. And how do we solve this puzzle in a sense? Mm-hmm. And can I come out on top? You know, and I started obviously in the professional world where for me in the military, explosives was part of that. Mm-hmm. And that was life-saving kind of things. And could I potentially, hopefully, beat any bad person, you know, that wanted to blow something up? And could I not be outsmarted, you know, because I knew my dog was good at it, but I'm also the weak link many times. The human is the weak part of it. And sometimes, though the answer is obvious, the dog is like, hey, it's this. We end up thinking, well, that can't be. That wouldn't be it.
Yeah.
Why would that be the answer? Or why could this be that, you know?
And that's probably my favorite part, you know, when sometimes the dog just looks at you like, he didn't get it.
Yeah.
Come on, it's here. And they sometimes look at us like, stupid human.
Yeah.
You don't get like, the order is here.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I love when dogs do that.
Yeah, especially when the human's like completely doubting it. And the dog's like, it's right here. And you're like, it can't be there. This doesn't make sense to me. And they're like, because it's odor. And odor doesn't do the things that make sense to us at times. So that's always a fun challenge. And I love seeing when other when we're working with other handlers and they're on that beginning journey themselves, that they really embrace that challenge, but also not get overly concerned or, like I say, we use the term wrapped around the axle because you're always spinning.
Okay.
So don't get so wrapped up in sometimes overly sciencing the thing. Well, there's this temperature and this wind direction and this kind of stuff, when the answer is actually really just get good at working your dog.
Yeah.
If you can get good at reading your dog.
Sometimes you can even like study all these things and place maybe the hide on purpose, and it's the dog that gives you the answer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the dog's behavior that will show, okay, the order goes through here, here, and here.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes and for me, most of the time, it's different than, what I thought.
Yeah.
Like, big surprise. You think that height is easy and that height is difficult. And actually, the dogs gives you the
opposite
answer. Yes. Like, the height you thought would be...
The hard one is easy.
Yeah. He finds it, like, in a couple of seconds. And the one that was supposed to be hard, the dog is struggling for whatever reason.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's always the fun part. So one of the things that we have seen in the difference between the States and in Europe is you guys almost all use markers.
Mm-hmm.
And in the States, it's hit or miss. In a sport world, it's very, I would say, less than 30%, because they've been told markers are bad.
Okay.
Or markers create confusion.
Mm-hmm.
So how does markers work here, but as soon as you cross the Atlantic, it all of a sudden falls apart and doesn't work anymore?
And do you think I have the answer?
Well, why have you guys embraced the use of markers, and what do you guys see the value in? Like, how do you do it? And your dogs work fine, but it goes to America and all of a sudden the markers no longer work anymore.
Actually, that's a tough question. I think we use it for pretty much long, and in other disciplines, like other sports, it's very popular.
Yep.
Although, yeah, it's, I would say, I think the clicker arrived in Switzerland a bit over 20 years ago. And there was this period where, and I was part of the thing, like, I wanted to teach everyone the clicker because I thought that was the most perfect tool for a dog to learn. And I soon realized that it wasn't for, every person, because I had people that they couldn't handle it, the timing. And they were like, oh, no, that's too much. I have to think about the dog, what I do, the clicker, that's too much. I was like, okay, fine. So over time, most dog trainers switched from clicker to marker, but like the word could be oui in French or bravo or yes. Actually, in nose work, I say yes, but I also have other markers that I use for, you know, other activities. And so it started to be normal to use a marker. So when it comes to training, like detection or nose work, that's just another training. So I think that for us, it was pretty clear that it was normal to use it. It was just part of the culture, maybe the dog training culture. So I don't know if, like in USA, in other sports, it's more popular than detection.
I was going to say, that's the part that's sometimes surprising, is in many other of these sport programs that these handlers compete in or train in, the marker is used and they have a pretty decent understanding of how to use it. The what happens many times is, in the experience I've had when I ask handlers why, is because they were told by another nosework trainers or those that run the organizations that, oh, you can't trust people to know how to use the marker, and they're going to use it wrong. And if they use it wrong, it's going to cause problems for the dog. And a lot of times my pushback to that is, well, then we should be teaching them how to do it right. So the example that they'll give, just to give some context to it, is, well, when the dog is learning the odor and you mark them, are you marking them for sniffing the box, or are you marking them? So therefore, you just shouldn't do it because it keeps it better. But then what happens is there's all this telegraphing from the handler when they're getting ready to reward, that now we have these other problems that are actually more significant than avoiding the marker to begin with. And the other thing that they'll do is they will cite this research where they'll say, oh, there was the research that was done where they had one person using a clicker, one person using a word, and then the one person using nothing. And they'll say, oh, look, they were all three the same. But if you read the actual study, and especially the last, like, the conclusion, it says that the human's bow, the movement, became the marker.
Okay.
So when they would move forward to get the reward, that became... So in obedience, I think, okay, using a body language is okay in certain things. But in detection, I don't want my body to be a tell. So it goes back to then the audible marker was a really good one.
Yeah.
So it's, and I understand that's normal as people. We will take bits of information and we latch onto that piece to support our argument without maybe taking the whole entire science. And I've done that myself. I've focused in on something before and said, oh, this proves what I thought. But then there's additional information, or maybe later another more broad or a research that studies something even further. And then I went, oh, okay, maybe there is something here. So what I encourage the viewers and listeners is clear communication is important. And a audible marker is something that is very helpful to make communication as clear as possible. This is why now we also use the inflatable or stuffed dogs at first, so people can get good at doing it. Yeah, the mechanics of it and the timing. without a dog in front of them. So that way, if there is a mistake, they can do this. We also, when we incorporate the dog, we don't do odor yet. We do some other marker exercises. So there's now a process. There's now, a fake dog, then a dog doing something else that's not odor. And then we clear up those sometimes mechanic or timing issues. And then by the time we go to odor with the dog, we have more chances for success.
Yeah.
So.
But it's, I think that's, talking about the marker and like maybe that's, you know, some trainers in USA said, adapted?
Or? Yeah, it doesn't adapt well from one to the other.
Yeah, or for detection, whereas it's normal to use it in another sport. As a human, you always have to question yourself and not because someone said this has to be like this. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, someone said it's not appropriate to use a clicker in nose work, so I don't use it. And you have to question yourself why.
Yeah.
Because maybe this person doesn't know how to use a marker. Mm-hmm. So that could be the reason.
Sure.
And so I always invite everyone, like when I teach, I tell them, okay, you have to question me or what I say. You have to question yourself, but you have to stay open. Mm-hmm. Maybe what I say is right, maybe it's wrong. So you always have to question, but not like asking questions, but you know, in general, and think about. And it's the same here. We have, I don't know who, but I guess it's a trainer that said, if you're doing nose work or detection, you cannot do man training.
Oh, wow.
And I was, you know, so it came to my ear like once and then twice.
Yeah.
And then the third time. And I was like, who's saying this? Where does it come from? Because I know a few people, and I do that myself, that I train one of my dog in like tracking training and detection.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make any problem. And so I started questioning, you know, other trainers that I know are teaching both.
Yep.
And I asked them, do you have, like, in your clients, people doing both with you? Like, mm-hmm. the same dog is doing detection and man training? And they say, yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, the police have proved this for many, many years.
They're doing it for ages.
Yeah.
So I don't know where it came from that, you know, someone like a trainer decided that, no, it doesn't fit.
It can't work.
Whereas the testimony I got, it's not scientists.
Yeah, but, yeah. It was based on their experience or their perspective.
Yeah, was that it was really beneficial to dogs to do both, because detection was bringing the dog being more
precise
into trailing. And when I've been teaching detection to dogs that were already trailing, they were just getting it like this.
Yeah.
It was just another nose game, and they were getting it quicker.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, it's just another nose game.
Yeah.
So it's not that because you're doing one that you can't do the other.
Yeah. And it's also about clarity.
Yeah.
You know, so the dog understands. I can understand sometimes when people, if something's confusion or there's confusion brought in, they may see the dog have a conflict or not perform as well. But, you know, again, it comes down to if you make it clear, this isn't such much of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. Everything comes down, I think, to obviously trainer perspectives, experience, and so forth. And I can understand the point of view from the trainers that were like, well, I don't think they should train markers or they should use markers because they don't know what they're marking for. But I also look at that as an excuse. If I'm a trainer, my job should be, I want to take the time to teach people how to do it and what we're marking for and creating that clarity. And I don't want to take away opportunities or take away tools because I feel some people may struggle with that. Why hold back those that understand it and that may be skilled with it? And then again, my job as a trainer, I want to help people and I want to teach. So these are all great teachable moments where if I break things down the right skill, you know, I can do this. And the part that it's kind of ironic, if we look at it as a time-saving measure, I don't want to take so much time to teach something as something like a marker. But at the same time, I look at programs that will spend multiple weeks searching for food, you know? So we always should look at something as what's a cost benefit. What's the big picture? What's my end goal? And what can I do in the early stages that plants the seeds for success at the end or what we get to our goal? So yeah, it's a definitely, like I said, sometimes perspectives or it's the way we've always done it gets in the way of progress.
I think you raised a good point because you said that the main argument is timing is because people, they don't have the right timing. But whether you're using a marker or not, if someone has a bad timing, it's still a bad timing.
Because correct.
If you're not using a marker, what would you do? You would go to the dog and reward directly?
Yes.
But if you have a bad timing, you will do the same.
Correct.
So first step is to teach timing. And I like to focus also on reading the dog during the hunt because then you can see the subtle signs. Mm-hmm. And then it makes things easier for people to then have a better timing. Mm-hmm. Because if you can see that the dog is in order, you can get prepared to at some point give a marker or give a treat. But yeah, I think if you have a bad timing, you have a bad timing. So that's, as you said, probably one of the first things that needs to be taught as trainer. And for those that go into competition, they say alert.
Yeah.
When they think that dog has found a hide. And for most dogs, if not trained either way, it becomes the marker.
For sure.
So even though you think you're not using a marker, actually you're using one. Because you could say alert on trials, but you could also, as preparation to trials, say alert in training. So believe me, like after 3-4 times, it's a marker.
Yeah.
And you can see it because dogs, they start like turning their head backwards to trainer. That means, you know, end of the session, I know I did right, pay me.
Yep. You brought up a good point, which is bad timing with or without the use of a marker happens. And that's so true. It also goes into the telegraphing. There's a marker physically. It's the reaching or the standing or the moving or whatever, you know, in this particular case, whatever that team does, that's predictable. The dog has learned that this thing that this human does is predictable.
Predict, yeah.
Yeah, to my reward. But unfortunately, that predictability is wrong a certain percentage of the time. So it's inconsistent. And the other point you made, the word alert becomes a constant condition reinforcer. But again, it's also inconsistent. This is where, Natalie, who competes in sport, she built in when she says alert, her dog doesn't move until it hears the condition reinforcer. And if it does, if it were to break away for whatever reason, like she brought up a good sequence one time where the dog alerts, she'll call alert, the judge says yes, and her dog has a marker of yes. It did initially. And the dog would break away when it would hear that yes. And then, so she changed to free.
Okay.
But at times, if he hears yes a certain way. He may break off, but her criteria is nothing happens. He goes back to Odor, holds position, and then she'll mark with free, and he's released.
Yeah.
Now, then those that get really into competition say, ooh, well, that's time. That could take 3 seconds of time, and that takes me from first place to 200th place, because 3 seconds is, you know, that brings up another point I want to discuss, which was the problematic aspect that time in the competition does it to detection.
I don't know, but so in USA, when does the timer stops? It's when you say alert. No, when the judge say yes.
Correct.
Right?
And so, if they get done with a search, they have to say finish, and then that stops the overall time. So there's not like a time stop per find. Like Natalie said, that depends on the level.
Yeah.
But overall, the handler has to say finish.
Yeah, let's say my marker is yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say alert, the judge confirms,
mm-hmm.
then I say finish.
Mm-hmm.
And actually what we mostly do here is, let's say, you know, advanced, we have like 3 orders.
Yep.
And when we come like to the third one, we say alert, finish. And so it stopped the timer.
Sure.
So then we have time to do whatever we want with our, you know, like indication if mm-hmm. you want something better, because the dog may be quiet because we've been talking.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really have an impact on like the time.
Now, what about the part about time that I see that has a impact on teams is the need to go as fast as they can through the search area.
Yeah.
And many times because they're going for speed, we now create we degrade the alert if there was one to even begin with sometimes.
Oh, that's for sure. I have seen it a couple of times that dogs trial, they lose the indication, or there is indication modification. That means they go from focus on the target to that's here. And then
mm-hmm.
because of the anticipation of the reward coming, they straight away turn their head. And this is, in my opinion, very dangerous, because if you don't address that in training, like you go back to mm-hmm. basics, or you go mm-hmm. back to building again a strong indication, trials over trial, you may just completely lose the indication, or just having a dog, especially those that are seeking for help from the handler. If your indication is this, then sometimes the dog is just questioning, and if you're not 100% sure of like being able to read your dog right when he's in order, you may say alert, and it was just the dog asking, so what's next?
it's a tough one, and you know, that's the part me that comes from initially the professional side of detection, where in most cases, I'm not pressured by time to find something. I can keep my sequences from training to reality to be the same. And when I watch those who got into sport and they work really hard to build certain parts of their detection, specifically, let's say, some type of stronger indication, so they have the ability to read their dogs better when their dog's in odor. But then competition side is how fast you can get through it, and the only way to get through it fast is to have less time at the odor so you can move on to the next one. There is this degradation of the response, and then just like you said, as they progress, that now my dog doesn't really commit to odor as strongly as it did when I was first learning. Now I can't tell the difference, or I have a harder time telling the difference between when my dog is just smelling something of interest, so a distracting odor, and what that looks like. And when I have that time pressure on my shoulder, I'm quicker to call something that is just interesting to my dog versus knowing what that looks like compared to what odor looks like, because now the commitment to odor has dropped significantly. So it's like it's a self-inflicted problem directed by the rules of competition that have, in many cases, set up for failure the alert.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I think I'm a bit different in competition because I'm not competitive in the way I want to be first. Mm-hmm. Actually, I don't care.
Yeah.
I want to go as far as I can with the dog I train because, you know, I have quite a few dogs and I have now three that I really go into competition with. And for me, it's just, okay, can I take this dog to the next level?
Yeah.
And the only thing that matters to me is the cube, the qualification. Mm-hmm. I don't really care if I'm going to be first, second, third, or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm competing against myself to see if I can be a better trainer or I can better read my dogs or I can go to the next level with that dog.
Yeah.
And
I like that philosophy.
And I've seen handlers that were excellent in training and they come into the competition and it's all panic. Mm-hmm. So I always tell them, it's just, you know, you have to come, enjoy, do what you're doing.
Yeah.
And have fun. So, and I think going away from that timer really mm-hmm. helps. Mm-hmm. The only thing that matters to me is to know, you know, where I'm at the end. Let's say, because with one of my dog, I'm competing at a level that I don't know how many highs are. So for me, it's important to know, let's say, like 30 seconds before time that, you know, I'm coming to the end. So maybe I'll have to take a decision if we find maybe two to say finish at some point.
Yeah.
But that's the only moment I focus on time.
I think most get into this because they want something to do with their dog. I don't think most get into it because they want to be competitive. Yeah. I think that's a byproduct. I think that happens, you know, when you start getting around your friends and you want to score. But many people got into it because they wanted to do something with their dog. And when you're new, it's hard to tell what information do I follow.
But there's also social effect because you do to competition to meet other people like you that are, you are linked mm. through that activity.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm doing nose work. I'm not doing agility. So I'm not really interested in going into agility trial to share with agility people because this is not my preference.
Yeah.
So trials are always, in my opinion, a nice moment to look at other dogs, how they are doing, and to also learn from other people. Maybe someone can give you a good tip or a judge can give you a good feedback. So trials are, in my opinion, one of the best learning
sure.
experience. It's just like for you, I mean, for operational people, the
real
field.
Search, yeah.
Yeah, real well, search. Yeah. That's you're also learning.
Oh, of course.
From every search, almost.
Yeah. I can't even tell you how many lessons
bad,
I've learned. Yeah. From my actual searches where, you know, I had my own questions and like, how did that happen? And, or, you know, so on and so forth.
Or why?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, you know, I always want people to keep enjoying it. It's tough when I see them stressing because of one thing or another, or dealing with so much confusion because, you know, when we say it all the time, you know, the having social media and the internet is great, things like we're talking about now. But for a new person, this is a lot of information to go through and say what is valuable, what's not valuable. And it's even hard to say sometimes because what's valuable to that team is different than what's other ones. And some people may get online and they get excited and they see somebody and they like what they do, but that person's a professional competitor. Like all they do is drive around and compete. And how do you measure yourself against something like that? There may be things that are great to take away, but then if you're somebody like that can get away with things where others can't, because like you said, they're going to trials frequently. So there's a learning ability that's happening really quickly.
And experience.
Yes. And then somebody who does it, you know, maybe once every 4 or 5 months, or getting into a trial is very difficult and so forth. So, you know, I just want to share with people that, do it because you love doing it. Do it because you love that relationship with your dog, and take your time. There's no hurry to get through the process. Enjoy the process. That's where even some of the special moments happen, is in those things where you're growing together as a team.
Yeah, exactly.
So go ahead.
And trial for us sport people is just as you... as for you, Real, it's a way to, it's almost an achievement. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, I've been training for so long and I think that now I'm ready.
Yep.
So, you know, in the trial, you have to sort of, I don't like this word, like prove it, but yeah. It's a way of testing it.
Sure.
And if you succeed, well,
yeah,
that means that the training was appropriate for that dog.
Mm-hmm.
And if for some reason there's a failure, so then there's a lesson to learn. Maybe, or most of the time, actually, it's the handler.
Yeah.
Like maybe the stress was too high, so the dog started stressing as well. Or maybe we didn't see some objects or a part of the search area that we completely missed because we were focused on, you know, another part. Mm. So then we failed because there was obviously a hide there. So it's just, again, I like to see trials as, you know, a good learning opportunity.
Yeah. Natalie said the same thing. You know, you put all this work into this training and it's kind of nice to have the validation when you go to trial and see what worked, what didn't work. It may motivate you too. Some, it may frustrate them because they had a different, I think I'm ready. And then, you know, Murphy's Law steps in and you're something happened you weren't expecting. But it's still information you can take away. And then that motivates you to prepare and train for the next one. And it comes down to balancing all that out, you know, balancing out the desire to, let's test ourselves. But manage the overly competitive side that may cause us to do things too soon. And as many people keep hearing me say more often, and I took this with Michael and Forrest, the dog gives you permission.
Yeah.
And sometimes we violate that because we get excited or we want to prove something. So that takes that a little bit away.
Yeah.
But if we remember the core values of just wanting to do stuff with our dog and have fun with our dog, it's all a journey.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's all about learning experience.
Yep. So how do people find you? How do they, if they wanted to learn more about you? And now I know most of the things that you have are going to be in French.
Yes.
So those that are watching that are maybe in Europe or obviously Switzerland or France, what is the easy way to find you and reach out to you or your website? And tell people what you do. I know you have online classes as well.
Yeah, I have online classes, but they're in French. I also have, I give workshops in Switzerland, France, and next year I'll teach in Belgium too.
Okay.
So mostly, you know, French speaking countries.
Mm-hmm.
But as you can see, I'm also talking English.
Yep.
And so people can reach me through my website.
Mm-hmm.
Which is chienzen.ch.
And I'll put it in the
perfect
section down below.
Yep. Yeah, because as you know, it's
maybe
French
not,
words.
Yes, exactly.
People don't know how to
yep.
spell it. And I can also give like private coaching in mm-hmm. English. That's mm-hmm. not because as the courses are in French, I mm-hmm. can just offer.
Yeah.
But I was thinking maybe I should offer something in English.
There you go.
But I have too much work.
Yeah, I know, right?
right
yeah.
<now. laughs>
And then you also have a podcast too.
Yes, which is, of course, in French.
Mm-hmm.
Because that came, you know, there is so many great things in English.
Yeah.
And I was meeting people, and they were asking, do you have resources? And I was like, yeah, you could go to this and this. And they were like, but it's in English. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
And that's also the main reason I wrote my book. It's because it took to offer resource in French.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, everything I offer is in French. Same for YouTube. But yeah, because that was like my mission to
sure.
inform people and give information so that we can just start this beautiful activity here.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for coming on the podcast, and thank you for having myself and Natalie out here doing a detection camp.
Thank you for coming. It's always a pleasure, and thank you for having me on the podcast.
Absolutely. And as usual, everybody, Canines Talking Sense podcast, where it's okay to be nosy. Thank you.